Hi, this is Andrew Phillips. Thank you for downloading the Graymeer Church of Christ Sermon Podcast. If you have any questions or if you'd like to contact us, check out our website at graymeer.com. We'd also love for you to visit with us in a worship service. You're always welcome at Graymeer Church of Christ.
Specifically to focus on two questions that deal with the existence of God and how we understand the proof of God's existence, as well as dealing with the problem of suffering. We asked several people in the community to turn in questions that had to do with the, if I could ask God just one question, what would it be? And over again, the question that was asked had to do with suffering. I would say probably 75% or 80% of our questions had to do with that. So that's one of the questions he'll be talking about tonight. Just to let you know a little bit about our format, he'll be speaking to us for about 25 or 30 minutes. And then if you have a question, this is being live streamed online, and so people can submit questions by Twitter. I'll be keeping an eye on that. But if you have a question, if you'll take one of those cards that's in the pew rack right in front of you, just jot down your question on the back of it. When we get to that section of the talk, I'll be walking up and down the aisle, and I'll get that from you, and we'll be sure to ask that. That'll help us facilitate the Q&A session a little bit more smoothly. And then we'll have a break at around 7 o'clock before we begin our next session. I did have reports that we had people watching in other countries last night, even as far away as India. And so we're excited about that. We're excited about ways that we can get the truth out to others. And so we look forward to sharing with that. I also was asked to remind all of us at the end of our second session, if we could wait and let the youngest children come in and sit in those pews, the 2-, 3-, and 4-year-olds, that way they can be in all in a central location, and they'll need to get through that door. So if we could wait to go out that door until they are all in, that would be really helpful. We had 501 last night, and I think we had about 170 children. And so we're thankful for all of those and grateful for you being with us tonight. Without taking up any more of his time, we'll ask Jim Baird to come and speak to us. I think the battery's right on this, so I just don't worry about it right now.
No battery? All right. I have one battery working. Not sure this is working, so we'll just lay that right there. Hey, thank you guys so much for having me. I was here back February, I think, of 2015, and I'm grateful to be asked back anywhere. So thanks very much. And I'm really impressed. Andrew, in his emails, was trying to explain what it was you guys were doing. This is a pretty unique thing that you've done, to actually ask the community, to make a big deal, to get the community's input on the questions that you guys are going to address, and then to address them, to put it out there. I love that concept, and I'm grateful to have a part in this. The first question I was asked is, how can we know God exists? And that's a big question. It definitely fits your theme for this series. How can we know God exists? Before I answer, I give you one way of answering that, I think, how we know that God exists, I want to address something else. And I want to do that with an illustration to start with. This actually was in the news a long time ago, from a private airfield, Phoenix Field, in Fair Oaks, California. One night, a passerby saw that there was a plane sitting on, you know, one part of the taxiway, and it was just on fire. It was like a ball of fire. And the passerby alerted the authorities. They came running out, and by the time they got there, at least the report said that plane had pretty much just melted into the asphalt. It had just kind of disintegrated there. They put out the flames as best they could. They actually found, stunned and singed, but not otherwise too badly hurt, a security guard that was employed there at Phoenix Field. And he had clearly was lying many, many feet away from where this event had taken place. And so they revived him, tended to his few burns and so forth, and they asked him what had happened. The story is really strange. He is a security guard hired by the airport to protect the planes, and he was stealing fuel. Okay, that's bad. It's a bad idea. He was stealing airplane fuel to put in his car. Bad idea number two. And he was just siphoning it out with just an ordinary hose, like some of us are old enough to have done. He was jamming a hose into the planes, and then he would start the flow, and he would siphon it out into a can, and he was trying to use that to power his car. The plane he picked had its tanks in the wings, like a lot of them do, but it had a baffle system, and the only fuel that was in there was actually kind of around a little passage in the baffles in the wing, and he was having a terrible time getting the hose to where the fuel was. He's already had two bad ideas. This is when he had his third bad idea. It was really dark. He couldn't see very well. He was having trouble getting the... And so he just struck a match to look. That's a good example of a partial idea. It seems like a solution to a problem, but it ends up creating more problems later. And I think today, when Christians are asked about their belief in God, or when people throw skeptical accusations at Christians about belief in God, I think we need to be alert for that phenomenon. There are people out there who are throwing stones at Christian faith who haven't really thought through the full implications of the stones they themselves are throwing. And so I want to start tonight's talk by giving you three bad arguments against believing in God. And all three of these are out there, and so I think they're ones that we need to know something about. The first bad argument against believing in God is, if you can't give me scientific proof of God, you shouldn't be believing in God yourself. That's a bad argument. That's so bad I don't even know where to start. Let me tell you a couple of reasons why that's a terrible argument against believing in God. Number one, how small would God have to be subject to human science? Seriously, what is science about? Science is about understanding our physical universe. It's really quite good at understanding a particular set of aspects of our physical universe. The kinds of things that are mechanical and follow laws, science is pretty good at tracking that down, figuring out what the laws are, writing the equations that describe what the physical processes that are going on. That's what science is good at. What in any of that makes us think that science would be big enough to understand or to get even a clue about the existence of God? There's nothing about science. You'd have to have a really small God in order for science to be able to catch a glimpse of him, at least a glimpse that he doesn't want to willingly give. To illustrate this, how many of you watch detective shows? Anybody watch, like CSI or... whatever. My wife and I were kind of addicted to detectives. How do detective shows work? How does that work? How do the detective... You can talk to me. I'm kind of up here on the holy pedestal, Andrew. I don't know that they will speak. They find clues, right? Are these clues that the criminals meant to leave? No. There are accidents, there are mistakes that the criminals made, right? And because every criminal makes mistakes, let's face it, real criminals are not very smart. And so criminals leave clues, the detectives come along, they piece the things together, and that's how they investigate what happened. In order for God to be subject to our science, whether he wants to be or not, he would have to be kind of an incompetent person like that. He would have to be accidentally leaving clues. Now, I can imagine a god like Zeus or Thor. They're not that smart, at least in the stories, and so they might leave a lot of accidental traces. But what does the Bible indicate about how smart God is? How smart is He? He's all the smarts. He's all, whatever smarts you got, He is all of those. He is, we call Him omniscient, and that means that there's no limit to His ability to understand and His knowledge, and He's far, far, far unfathomable to us. And so there is not even a ghost of a chance that we're going to find evidence scientifically for God that He doesn't intend for us to find. That's just crazy. In addition, the second reason why this is a bad objection to the belief in God is people who say that, this is where the partial idea comes in, people who say that would not be willing to apply that across their whole life. No one who says, well, you shouldn't believe in God because you can't provide scientific evidence, just ask them, well, are you willing to give up any belief you have if you can't provide scientific evidence for it? Because they aren't. They haven't thought that through. It's a partial solution. There is no scientific proof that you can give to me that you have thoughts and emotions. It's a weird thing, but it's the truth. What science would ever show that you are thinking and feeling the way I am? What possible a set of experiments could we do to find out whether or not you are a real person with real thoughts and feelings, or whether you're a robot sent back from the future to maybe kill Sarah, whatever her name was? Okay, only a few people laughed at that. Only a few Terminator fans in the audience. There's actually no test for that. That's a famous problem. There's no scientific test for that. There's no science behind all the entirety of morality. You know, if you are ever accused of murder, there are a lot of different things you can do to try and prove your innocence. You can say, well, it was really somebody else who did it, or the evidence is not conclusive. But the one thing you really could never get away with in a courtroom is to say, there is no scientific evidence that murder is wrong. Even though that's a totally true statement, how far do you think that would get you with the jury? It wouldn't mean anything to them. Of course there's no scientific evidence. There's no scientific evidence that anything is either right or wrong. Science doesn't deal with morality. It doesn't care about morality. That's not one of its things. Does that mean there's no such thing as right and wrong because science can't identify it? No, of course not. We know lots of things. We have a lot of well-justified beliefs that don't have anything to do with science. That's just a bad, bad argument against God. The second argument against God is kind of like that people sometimes give. You aren't allowed to believe in God if you can't give me conclusive proof. In other words, you can't believe it unless you can prove it to me. Christians, don't fall for that one. That puts all the power in the hands of the religious skeptic. They are perfectly free to just sit back and whatever you say, whatever evidence you bring up, they say, well, hasn't convinced me yet. Hasn't convinced me yet. And it's fake. It's another one of those partial ideas. People who say that would not be willing to say, well, I will be willing to throw out any belief I have if I can't give you conclusive proof for it. There are just too many things for which we believe which we don't have conclusive proof for. How many of you think that you could convince a skeptic who your mother is? I don't think you could. You don't have conclusive, I mean, you have really good proof, let's face it. But you don't have conclusive proof. If somebody really is determined to be skeptical, every piece of evidence you bring forward, they can say, well, that could be fake. It's possible that that photograph is doctored. It's possible that your memory is inaccurate. We just don't have conclusive proof for things like that. How many of you think that you can conclusively prove that all people should be treated equally before the law? How many of you think that's true, by the way? Okay, well, I have too much philosophy. People have stopped believing in civil rights. Okay, that's bad. That's bad when that happens. How many of you think it is wrong to treat, you know, for instance, let's say poor people or people of a particular race or whatever, unequally in front of the law? Yeah, I mean, we know that. Do you know that? I mean, you know that. Well, that's a piece of our knowledge. How would you prove that conclusively to someone who doesn't believe it? Let's say the philosopher Aristotle, who didn't think that was true. And neither did Socrates, to be honest. Neither of them thought that you should treat everybody the same before the law. They both thought there were some groups that deserved more rights and other groups that deserved less rights and some groups that deserved no rights at all. How would you conclusively prove? Well, you wouldn't. There is no conclusive proof for that. I think it's right, but it's difficult to prove it to a skeptic. And so I don't think that's a decent argument against belief in God. And here's another one that kind of gets me irritated. The third argument against God that I don't like is you aren't allowed, kind of pointing the finger at the Christians, you aren't allowed to believe in God unless you can show me at least one thing that can't be explained naturally. Now, as it happens, I think there are some things that can't be explained naturally, but I think that's a terrible argument anyway. Because think about it. Basically, this is the argument that says, unless you can show me something that there's no possible scientific explanation for, no possible natural explanation for, that would be conclusive evidence for God. And unless you can do that, you aren't allowed to believe in God. There is no evidence for God. That's said a lot of times, but let's think that through just a little bit. Why do we live in a natural universe as opposed to just a chaotic mess? Why is that?
Because God arranged it.
That's right. The only reason we aren't just in a chaos, the only reason we have nature that we can understand is because there is a God. God, I mean, it's not like here's nature and here's God, and occasionally God might come in and fiddle with nature, which otherwise has nothing to do with him. God is the creator of this. And he's the one who made it into a universe, as opposed to just a chaotic mess. He is the one who formed nature to be recognizably natural. And who makes it possible for human beings to understand nature? Scientifically and all the other ways we have for understanding the natural world. Who makes that possible? Where does that come? If you didn't have God doing that for you, then there is no reason to expect that however we got these 3.5 pounds of gray soggy stuff in our skulls, that these little physical objects that we call our brains would have the ability to actually figure out how the natural world works. There's no reason to expect it. What you'd expect is that, well, you know, we impose a little bit of order here and there, but it's nothing about the deep truths of the world. That's just the way it is. If there's a God, it makes sense that our brains make sense, are able to make sense of the world, and that there's a world out there that is capable of being made sense of. Both of those things flow very nicely from the idea that God's the creator, the rational creator. Otherwise, you just don't have it. And so, when somebody says, you can't believe in God unless you can show me something where, you know, the natural processes are violated somehow, I don't like that. I actually think there are some things that violate the natural process. I still don't like that objection. Because what you're saying is, God, who is really, 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 really smart, intended to make a world that we could understand because it flows by natural processes, and he intended to make a world for us to be able to figure out how the natural processes operate. He intended to do both of those things, and now you're coming back and saying, but I'm not going to believe in that God unless you can show me places where that doesn't work. That's crazy. The actual fact is, every time we are able to figure out anything scientifically, it is another miracle from God. It is another blessing from God. The only reason human beings are ever able to figure anything out in science or in any of the other ways in which we understand our world is because God has made this a human-sized universe for us, capable where we are capable of understanding it. And so I don't like it when people say, show me a place where God messed up, and then I'll believe in God. That's almost what this objection seems to reduce to. So I don't like any of those three objections to God. Why do we believe in God? Why do we believe in God? Well, to be honest, I mean, I think there are a lot of reasons. Paul says faith comes by hearing, and hearing comes from the Word of God. I actually think that one of the reasons that anybody believes in God is because God has talked to them through His Word. And there are a variety of ways in which that happens. Sometimes you hear it spoken. Sometimes you read it yourself. Sometimes it's lived out in front of you. Sometimes, you know, you're not even aware of what's going on. But faith comes by hearing the Word of God. And so I think that's the real reason why we believe. I also think that people just look at the world and they realize this is a God kind of world, not a chaotic kind of world. This is the kind of world that where God, which makes more sense if God is real than if God is not real. Let me illustrate this by asking you guys a question. Now, this is an audience participation portion of our program, which requires you to participate a little bit. Tell me one reason, somebody here, why you are glad you're a human being and not, say, a can of soda pop. Why are you glad you're a human being? Give me one reason.
I have the ability to love.
I have the ability to love. Yeah. And actually, I've done this experiment a lot of times, and that one almost always comes up. Yeah, love is one of those things that makes life worth living. The ability to love. The ability to love my wife. The ability to love my children. The ability to love other people. Yeah, that's right. Okay. If there is no God, if we arose out of chaos by cold, unfeeling processes, and we will eventually fade back into nothingness of those same chaotic processes. We've got a brief moment where we think something important's going on, and then that all just dissolves again. If that's true, then what does love amount to? Nothing at all. It's just a twitch in your brain. Evolution or something else has programmed you to have these emotions, to squirt out these hormones, and to form these attachments, and to have great, you know, attach great emotional significance to these emotions, and yet they mean nothing at all in the grand scheme of things. That's one view. And the other view is love is one of the greatest things about being a human being because God is love. And you are in the image of God. You are meant to exemplify love, to show love back to God, and to love the people around you. First and second great commands of being human. Love God with everything you've got, and love your neighbor as yourself. Love is really, really, really significant if there is a God. And a lot of people just look and say, I really think I live in that second universe way more than I think I live in that first universe. I don't think it's all that complicated. Give me another reason why you're glad you're a human being and not a soda can. Yes? I'm made a little lower than the angels. I have been crowned with dignity and honor. Right? Even if I'm not, you know, a king, even if I am not a star athlete, I go about my life and I try to be good to the people around me and I try to do my job with competence. And my life matters, right? My life matters. Again, that makes perfect sense if you are God's creature. You are made in the image of God. God has placed you here and He has a purpose for you. He ultimately wants what's happening in this part of your life to feed into the next much, 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 much bigger part of your life, which is the kingdom of heaven. And He is helping you in this life so that you can have that future with Him. Your life can have meaning in that circumstance. That's one way of viewing the world. The other way of viewing the world says, nope, you are just kind of a totally accidental byproduct of forces that don't give a rip about you and aren't interested in you whatsoever. You exist for a little bit here, kind of like, oh, a whirlpool in a bathtub. As long as the energy holds out of the water draining, you're there and you think you're all these great thoughts. And then once that's gone, you'll be gone, and that's all there is to you. Those are two really different views of the universe, and I think people believe in God because they say, I actually think the first one makes way more sense than the second one. That's not the way. I don't live like the second one is true. I live like the first one is true. Give me another. Let's do this one more time just for fun. Give me one more reason why you're glad you're a human being as opposed to a can of pop. I have the ability to reason. That's exactly right. Great one. I love that one. That's a good one. I have the ability to reason. Why do I care about reason? Because I want to know the truth. I want to sort out truth from falsehood. I want to sort out truth from opinion. And that's good in and of itself to do that. If you are made by God, if this is God's world, that totally makes sense that you can do that. At least some of the time. We don't always get it right, obviously. We are very limited in our reasoning ability. But it totally makes sense that some of the time you can do that because God has made you. And He has made this world a human-sized, human-shaped world for us to be able to reason and function in it. And so, yeah, I have the ability to reason. That makes me different, and that gives a certain kind of valence to the human life, as opposed to the other view that says, look, the whole universe just arose out of chaos. It's a brief blip of order. Before it recedes back into more chaos, and us and everything else in the universe is really just the byproduct of just chance and mindless laws operating, and we will evaporate when the rest of the universe evaporates. On that view, your reason is not the ability to see the truth. It is whatever the evolutionary process has programmed into your brain up to this point. Mostly it's going to be about reproduction and whatever it is that's going to make you better able to get your DNA into the next generation. Truth, separating opinion, all of those things really don't enter into this picture of the world. And I think people just look. I just think they say, I'm pretty sure I'm living in the first view, not in the world described by the second view. I don't think it's hard. I actually think this is a case for Christians, as far as the existence of God is concerned. I think it's more, number one, be confident in what you already believe. And number two, ask people more questions. Ask them to follow out the logic. If they say, I don't think there's a God, if they say, I think we all just got here by evolution or by random chance, ask them more questions. And what started out as a partial answer may be exposed, and they realize, oh man, what I'm believing makes a total mockery of human life. It makes all of the things that make life worth living disappear into nothingness. I really can't think that view is true. I don't live like that view is true. I live like the God view is true. Why am I resisting accepting the existence of God? I actually think that's the proper way for us to deal with this issue. What's the time? I've gone past my time. Have I?
No, that's good. We can start collecting questions.
Okay. Well, I had one more thing, but I will just... Maybe you'll ask the right question, and I'll get to say it anyway. Thank you, guys, very much.
If you have one, we'll start over this way. And if you could just as we continue, you've mentioned some of the things, the arguments that you didn't like. What are some of the most common ones, even if they're not new, that we read in some of the books that are kind of the bestsellers from the sort of group of new atheists, what would be some things that tend to come up?
Yeah, the weirdest one, and I was shocked because there's such a consensus about this. Andrew mentioned the new atheist. There's a, as you guys know, after 9/11, there was a backlash against all religion. And so there were a crop of best-selling books saying the problem wasn't crazy people using Islam to do terrible things. It's religion itself that's terrible. And so you had some best-selling atheists like Dawkins and Hitchens and Harris and so forth. Really almost uniform was their view of what faith is. And to be fair, this view of faith is actually in the dictionary a lot, but it's still flawed. Faith is by all of these guys, tends to be defined as faith is believing when you don't have good evidence. Faith is believing something when you don't have good evidence. I just think that is a crazy, crazy, crazy way to define faith for a couple of reasons. It actually, what would it be like? How would Christianity be different if that's what we thought faith was? If we really acted like that's really what faith is. It's believing when you don't have good evidence. How would the way we act be different? Like, let's take a typical over 50s Bible class. Anybody ever argue in your over 50s Bible class at Graymere? Because they do at the Wilshire Church of Christ where I preach. Especially the ladies. The ladies, they know their Bible. And they, when I make a claim, they want me to show them in the text what the evidence is. If we really thought faith is believing when you don't have evidence, how would those ladies act instead? What would they say? Anybody want to guess? They would say, I don't care what the evidence says. I just believe it in my heart. Anybody read Acts 2 lately? What was Peter's sermon like in Acts 2? Did he get up and say, well, I know a lot of stuff about Jesus. I could tell you about the prophecies. I could tell you about the miracles he did. I could tell you I actually saw him resurrected from the dead. But I'm not going to do that because that would destroy your faith. I don't want to pollute your faith with evidence. Is that the way Peter acted? I mean, it's just crazy. That isn't the way Christians think about the relationship between our faith and evidence. We think there's lots of evidence. We think there's lots of rational things to say about our faith. Now, here is one thing I do think is true. We realize, and I think the new atheists don't realize this, and it's part of our job to help them think through their own position. We realize that when you make a fundamental commitment, whether it's to Christianity or to anything else, that goes beyond just the rational evidence you're able to present. Oftentimes, that's a full person commitment, and you need to evaluate it in that same way. And so it's not always very easy to just pull up into your conscious mind all the reasons why you are that way. You may never be aware of all the reasons why that seems to make sense. That doesn't mean it's not rational, and that doesn't mean it's not based on evidence. So that's one. You have another question?
Yes. One of the questions we have, and I know this this will be covered some in our second session, but how is the best approach to convincing a person reared behind the Iron Curtain of communism that there is a God when they look at the way they have seen children who suffered and some of the suffering that took place there? What would be something you could say to them, or maybe a way you could steer that conversation and try to share that with them?
Yeah. Well, that is the topic of my second talk. The second big question you guys asked me to talk about is, why does God allow suffering? And so we're going to try and address that. But I will say, I have a really close friend. He and I were very close in graduate school. We lived far apart, so we don't get to see each other very much anymore. And he left Christianity. I mean, he was trained just like me to be a preacher in theology school. He got a master's of theology just like me. He left the faith for probably a good 6 or 7 years over this issue. Why does God let children suffer? Why does he let people suffer the way that he does? And then one day I got a call. I was really sad because he told me why he was leaving. And then one day I got a call from him, and he said, I couldn't do it. I couldn't sustain it. And he gave several reasons, some of which we've sort of talked about. But the biggest one, he said, was it didn't help with the problem of suffering to get rid of God. Now I had all the same children suffering and no God. I had all of the same suffering, and now it's totally pointless. I had all of the same suffering, and there's no heaven. Nothing. And so he said it actually made it much, much worse. And so that's one reason he kind of came back to faith in God in spite of suffering. Okay.
One of the questions that we had last night had to do, I guess the larger issue is the relationship between faith and science.
Yeah.
But if you have, for example, if you have carbon dating that is controversial and some people, should you accept it, should, you know, and then there are other forms of science, maybe DNA testing that we say, oh, well, sure, that's accurate. How do we navigate that? So maybe if you could just share a little bit about faith and science in that relationship.
Yeah. Well, I mean, my view is the only reason we have confidence in science, I actually think the only worldview under which you've got legitimate confidence in science is a worldview that's got something like the Creator God, a concerned Creator God in it. Now, Christianity is not the only worldview that has that. Islam has it. Judaism has it. Certain versions of Hinduism have it. Lots of religions have the idea of a concerned Creator God. But if you don't have a concerned Creator God, then you run into the problem I was discussing a little bit earlier tonight, which is you've got this world, you've got our 3 pounds of soggy gray stuff in our skulls, and you don't know what the connection's likely to be between those. You know, at best, evolution's going to do a few things to help us survive, but the idea that it's going to, this soggy gray stuff is going to give us deep insight into how nature works is very, it becomes very far-fetched very quickly. And so I actually think the best reason for believing science is that God is real. But if you believe there's a God, then you think science is really important. It's a gift from God. It's a blessing from God. But it is science done on God's world. And that kind of puts a limit on it as well. That kind of tells you when science is the most trustworthy, and it also tells you times when it's likely to possibly be messed up when it comes in conflict with God's word, let's say. Now, you have to be careful. Sometimes what we say is God's word, and what we're sure God must be saying in this verse or that verse, we need to have a second look. But I think that science can be moderated by what God has revealed about himself and what he's revealed in his word.
Are there any others? We have a few questions that I think will fit well in our next session, but are there any others that that I've missed so far? Yes, Brother Bob?
Okay. When you make a comment on the claim that science makes that this is 400 million years old, or this happened 65 million years ago, which does not relate at all, as I understand, biblical time.
Yeah. Well, I will tell you, and I may get in trouble for this, I started out my career much more convinced of a young Earth, and I am not as convinced of that as I now as I was back then. And so I am not clear that the book of Genesis gives us the kind of dating that we sometimes have assumed that it does. To describe why I think that is a whole other lecture, which you didn't ask me to come and do. But that's kind of where I come down. And so I am not as worried. I mean, I still think science gets it wrong sometimes. You know, that's certainly possible. But I'm not as worried about the long ages of the earth and so forth. I actually think there are scriptures that indicate, in some cases, the earth might be quite old, as well as others.
All right, Jerry. If there are no others, we'll take our break right now, and we will try to start our second session at 7, and we'll be able to get to some of these other questions as well. So thank you, Dr. Baird, and we'll start back at 7. Come up and to help us work through this big question.